tonight on Arena, Lenny Abrahamson on how the arts can survive the current crisis, and new albums from Bob Dylan, Phoebe Bridgers and John Legend up for review. Five one double 51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. This morning, the expert advisory group set up by the Arts Council to advise on the arts in a post-COVID world published its report. The report is called Survive, Adapt, Renew. And I'm joined on the line now by film director Lenny Abrahamson, who is one of the committee members on this expert advisory group. Lenny, I was just looking at the paradox described at the very beginning of the report, Survive, Adapt and Renew. Very pertinent, it has to be said. In a time where the arts have never been more appreciated or needed, they find themselves facing a profound existential threat. How profound is the threat?
I think it's a really serious moment for the arts, particularly the performing arts, but actually right across the whole sector. And if you can imagine, I suppose, that from the moment that lockdown came, all activity in performing arts particularly, but it's theatres, cinemas, also galleries, all of it just completely stopped. All the festivals that would have taken place over the summer, everything that was happening regionally, locally and nationally, all stopped. All musicians pretty much out of work straight away. And most, a vast majority of people in the sector would work freelance. So it wasn't always easy for those people to, access the same level of support that people in PAYE jobs could. So yeah, a hugely dangerous time. And we're also, one of the things that we talked about in the group was that the arts have, I suppose, been, I think, people even in government would admit this privately, compared to the rest of Europe and the developed world, has been kind of underfunded here. And that's our pre-existing condition as a sector, which means that the kind of the COVID shutdown has been of particular seriousness in this aspect of it, along with, other aspects of the service economy.
And I know part of the job of the expert advisory group is to particularly look at how the 20 million in extra funding that was announced, how that should be distributed and how it should be spent. But really and truly, that 20 million probably should have been there anyway, in terms of that underfunding.
Yeah, in fact, the Arts Council, I know, has been trying to bring its funding up to that level over a number of years. And so I think, all we're doing is and I'm delighted that I'm not complaining about that decision. It's exactly what was asked for. But all it really does is it's a temporary emergency measure to stop the sort of damage in the sector that would take years and years to repair. It will stop that from happening. It will keep people connected to the sort of institutions and places where they've made their work. It'll stop people leaving to do other things, and it will stop companies going bust, some serious and, national institutions. But, looking into the future, we do have to ask these questions. Like, given how central the arts have been, as you just, as was so well expressed in the quote you just gave, like, I think what happens is people love art, but don't always think about the arts. So, it's so present in people's lives, I think, that it's not, it's almost invisible. It's like it's part of our world. It sustains us through particularly dark times like we've just been involved in, or we are continuing to be involved in. But it doesn't come from nowhere. It comes from people working, and it comes from developing talent over a period of time. It comes from, just nourishing the sector at all sorts of levels. And also it's a very interconnected sort of world. So in our world of film, you've got people who are designers who may have studied in NCAD, have come from a fine art background or a theatre background. You've got people who studied in the Lear or who just, who've been through the theatre sector to get to film acting, and then you've got people who work directly, have come directly from film schools or whatever. All of those things are part of an ecosystem that is under severe threat at the moment.
I was thinking normally at this time of year we'd be getting ready to go to Galway for the Arts Festival. We might be thinking about doing some kind of public interview with somebody of your stature, somebody like that in the town hall as a programme.
Sure.
We'd be thinking about getting to Kilkenny. Now, we're a programme. I'm thinking about what about all the numerous events that are at those festivals, and the numerous
artists who are now sitting at home. I've heard this idea, shouldn't it great, you're at home, now you have time to create. Yeah. But consistently, the people I have spoken to on this programme can't create out of an anxiety as much as anything else. Many people feeling that. And yet, that's not just artistic anxiety. It's simple, can I put the bread on the table anxiety?
Well, yeah. I mean, people really, in this part of the economy, people have lived on tiny margins, or as individuals, from sort of hand to mouth for an awful long time. And so the emergency is immediate as soon as the work stops. I'm thinking of musicians, I'm thinking of painters. I mean, there are people who can work, and some do, some are working, writers can work, painters can paint. But for those people, where does that work go, right? But, you know, if you're writing a play, where does it get put on? If you're writing a screenplay, who's going to be able to make it? If you're a musician, you can compose, but how are you going to perform? But then, they're the people who can do it. There are plenty of people whose work just can't happen, and there are arts workers as well. You know, stagehands, film electricians, all these people whose work is just gone in an instant. It's a very stressful time, and I think it just reveals some of the problems that we've had in the sector before this. Yeah. And I'm hoping that there's going to be an appetite for taking a serious look at it in future. It's such a central part of people's lives and audiences as well. So all the festivals that you're talking about, it's not just the practitioners and the theatre makers and the writers and the artists. It's also like all of the engagement that would have happened at festivals, you know, all of the opportunities of people to be involved locally in arts events that kind of are important in communities. All of that has stopped.
Yeah, and the other side of that is the audiences themselves, the anxieties that they're going to be feeling around. Sure. You've gone back to a theatre, you know, we've just heard the announcement that 50 people indoors from the 29th of June.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a very small cinema. It's a very big cinema, probably with social distancing involved and and you're going to be just putting 50 people inside it.
Exactly.
If cinemas are going to be part of that, if theatres are going to be part of that.
Exactly, yeah. And I mean, you look at the theatre, well, how do you make the show in the first place if there are still social distancing rules in terms of rehearsal? But also, what are the economics? If you have a situation where you're going to open a building, say, just looking at really practical, you've got to open the building, whether it be a cinema complex or a theatre, and you've got to do all the things that involves, and you've got to bring people in and rehearse, and paying actors or paying staff in the cinema or whatever it is, or all the costs of bringing the films in, it may in fact be a greater burden to have the 50 people than to not open at all. You know, very difficult situation for cinema owners, etc.
And this brings up another question around what's done with this extra money, you know, because one of the things that the report also talks about is it says that underlying everything in this is that arts workers, artists and arts organisations should be benefited by the detail working out of every measure. We need to get the money directly to the artists.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm even thinking about, you know, funding that has already gone out there that possibly was there for projects. Should this be going directly to the artists who would have been involved in those projects had they been able to be realised?
I mean, I think that what the Arts Council are trying to do, and it's a massive task, you know, and I'm thinking specifically about the Arts Council. There's similar things going on in Screen Ireland and in other agencies. But in terms of the Arts Council, a lot of thought has gone into that and continues to go into that. How can you structure these bursaries? How can you structure the channels by which this money goes out so that it isn't just going into keeping institutions going, for example, or, you know, that it's really going to the artists? Like, that was one of the things that the group was most clear about, that we had to recommend strongly, as you just mentioned, that whatever ways are chosen, that they are keeping people going. I mean, really, at the most basic level, keeping people going who would have been working otherwise.
One final question, Lenny. Last time you were in speaking to us, it was just ahead of the screening or the broadcast of Normal People, which obviously has had such a phenomenal success. Now, what about projects like that? Where is the investment from that going to come from? Because that's big money that it takes to make a series of that size and of that stature, and for it to actually be realised.
Sure. I mean, there's a bigger question there, because like with Normal People, we had support from here we have had in many ways, and Screen Ireland being a big part of the story. But actually with Normal People, you know, we took it to the BBC, and because of how, you know, the kind of chronic situation in terms of funding with RTE, they just would not have the capacity to develop it with us. And it's such a pity, because actually for relatively small money at the level of seed money, you know, yeah, where you're protecting an idea and creating the sort of doing the creative work at the very, very beginning, the opportunities to sort of make things which have a global impact are vast. But we really are so starved here, you know, across various parts of this arts ecosystem. We're so starved that we're forced to take really great things like that outside the country. And while there were, I mean, we made it here, there were a huge amount of spending happened here, and there are big benefits, I suppose, you know, in terms of that awful phrase, soft power and, you know, attention to the country and tourism and all sorts of stuff like that. But actually we have so much creative ability, and that's a truism that people trot out, but it really is the case. But unless we were prepared to make sensible and actually not very large in the scheme of things investments in the national broadcaster, right, in, you know, the arts generally, we won't realise the benefits.
Well, I think lots of people in and around this particular area might be very glad to receive some of that seed money and help you develop a project that would come out in the way normal people did. Lenny, thanks very much for speaking to us this evening. That's Lenny Abrahamson there speaking to us about that Arts Council report and the expert advisory group that he was part of. This Sunday, June the 21st, President Michael D. Higgins will launch a nationwide musical tribute to the country's frontline workers from the steps of Áras on Uachtaráin. At 6 p.m. on Sunday, European Music Day, President Higgins will be joined at the Áras by four musicians to perform Beethoven's Ode to Joy, or Ode d'un Luchoira, the European anthem. Immediately following that, soprano Mairead Buick will lead a larger group of musicians and singers to continue the tribute on the steps of the National Concert Hall in Dublin. And these tributes will be streamed on a specially created website, odetojoy.ie. But musicians and music lovers across the country are being invited to join. Among those supporting this event is the RTE Orchestra, and the General Manager, Joe Chibby, is with me in studio this evening to talk about this. A really unique event, it has to be said, on Sunday. Joe, what's the orchestra's involvement? Are you going to be on the steps of the concert hall socially distanced, as I saw you this morning on the Homeschool Hub, by the way? Some of the members of the orchestra looking great and sounding great.
Will you see us coming out of Croke Park? I think we're doing a little piece out of Croke Park, so that'll be exciting as well. You see that, a much bigger venue than the School Hub. I think on Sunday, Professor James Kavanagh, who is a professor in the Royal Irish Academy of Music, decided that this was a good idea and he was going to do it. So it's been in train for quite a long time. And Ode to Joy, which is it's very few notes in the tune, in the melody, and he wants the whole island to play this piece at 6 p.m. on Sunday, which is International Music Day, of course, to thank all the frontline workers. So I think it's an incredible achievement to get this on.
And I'm a bit unclear about one thing. I know the new lyrics have been written for this, because it's originally a Schiller poem that Beethoven set to music, or a section of that poem that Beethoven set to music. Have new lyrics been written as well for this particular performance?
They have, by Catherine Ann Cullen. Catherine has written a whole new lyric for this. Would you like to hear the lyrics?
Yes, I should make you sing it along with with this version that I have from the Grand House.
I'd love to sing it, but I'll read it instead. Thank you to the frontline crew. You've kept our whole world turning, paying heed to all we need. For you, our candles burning. Gurav Mila Mahagwiv is Buikas Liv, for all you give. Thank you to the frontline crew. You've kept our whole world turning. So it's quite beautiful.
Yeah, let's have a listen to actually the original version, which features the Schiller words, and we'll see where those particular words fit in. The frontline crew who've kept our whole world turning. So there it goes. It fits perfectly. Thank you to the frontline crew who've kept our whole world turning. So the idea is, Joe, there will be this performance, first of all at Áras an Uachtaráin, then there'll be the performance on the steps of the National Concert Hall where you're involved with Maria Buick is singing there. But you want people from around the country to do their own version and send it to you.
Absolutely, yeah. So I think that's going to go out. It's going to be streamed. I think people, similar to the clapping that took place very early on in this pandemic, we would like to go out and we would like to sing this and we'd like to play it. It's a very, very simple tune. I mean, its register is only 5 notes, you know, so it's actually quite easy and very easy to play for all types of musicians, whether they're traditional musicians, whether they're jazz musicians, classical musicians. This is very easy. And we'll have a number of RT concert orchestra people joining Mairead on the steps of the National Concert Hall.
Of course, it's Beethoven. So therefore, he can do that with just 5 notes.
Incredible.
This is the Ode to Joy is if the final movement isn't of it comes into play at the final movement of Beethoven's final symphony. In fact, Symphony number 9, he never got to Symphony number 10. Yeah. How important a piece is it in the general scheme of classical music, would you say, the Ninth Symphony and specifically that last big choral movement, the symphony often called the Choral Symphony?
The Choral Symphony, yeah, indeed. I think that it brought unity and hope and joy to that time, you know, so I think it was really important that allegedly when he was conducting it through, he was completely deaf, and at every point people used to stand and they'd wave their hats and handkerchiefs, so immediately it was a hit. And he would have known that going into it. So he wanted to accomplish something. And like every artist, they're very good at standing up and making themselves known and making themselves heard. So he obviously saw this as an opportunity. It was, you know, the end of the Napoleonic Napoleon's reign, et cetera, so he lived through that and he wrote through it. So he saw all that going on and he wanted to make a statement. And his statement was new, joyous humanity. You know, so he was looking for a new hero.
And of course, it became the European anthem then as well, subsequently in the 1970s. But just at that premiere, there's an awful tragedy, isn't there, to involve? Yes, while they waved their handkerchiefs and all the rest, obviously the conductor, apart from the choir seats in front of him, and there was a choir there to sing the Choral Symphony.
That's right.
The conductor has his or her back to the audience, and in Beethoven's case, he didn't hear the applause.
Heard nothing. He could only see it. And at the very end, the most incredible thing is that he kept conducting when the symphony was over. So he definitely couldn't hear anything. And he's obviously had his eyes closed, let's presume, you know, and he couldn't see anything. So the contralto actually took his hand and she turned him around, you know. He was still beating bars, and the symphony was over, and the audience were, of course, they adored him. They must have known at that time that his hearing was gone, you know.
How much of an innovation was it to have a choir in a symphony? I mean, we're talking about a symphony orchestra. Normally that's what you would have been dealing with, just instrumental music. Were there any, you know, shrieks of, "My Lord, what are you doing, Mr. Beethoven, your choir?"
He changed the rules and people didn't like it. But then, you know, he paved the way for Bruckner and Mahler and all those guys, you know, Brahms included, you know. Berlioz, you know, the crits came out and they said, you know, he shouldn't be doing this, putting a choir in the fourth movement of a symphony, you know. So Berlioz, who was a bit of a playful old character, he loved this, you know. So this is the guy who wrote Carnival of the Animals. And Carnival of the Animals, again, was about his composer friends. He was criticising them for his children's amusement, you know. So that was never actually meant to be published, and it was, you know. So, but Berlioz loved this. He thought it was the best thing in the world, you know, that this stick a chorus in, stick some singers in the fourth movement. It's brilliant, you know. So, and of course, it's one of the greatest pieces on the planet. And I was a former member of the National Symphony Orchestra, and I've played it, and it's got huge demands. You know, you're broken by the end of it, you know, physically and psychologically.
You mean by the end of the whole symphony? Because remember, you are asking people to sing the Ode to Joy on Sunday evening, so they're not going to be physically broken at the end of that, are they?
That's the easy bit. That's the easy bit, yeah. I shouldn't say that. Apparently the soloists now, if you're a soloist in that symphony, it's hardship. But, you know, for the choral part, apparently it's just beautiful.
And Schiller's words to this, they were pretty much, I suppose, we're in a moment of hope now, hopefully, that this, you know, the restrictions are beginning to lift, and it is a wonderful way to say thank you.
Yeah.
But historically, I suppose, Schiller was similarly celebrating hope in a European sense.
I think so, you know, and he had a revision made of the words, and we think that Beethoven used this revision of the words, and Schiller was dead at the time, and you could imagine at this time, you know, if you want to change people's words, there's a question mark over did Beethoven change Schiller's words, and in this time you'd have to get a letter from the publisher, but I think in those days you did what you wanted.
Okay, so. Well, definitely we'll have changed words for some of the performances on Sunday. Now, I presume that Catherine Ann Cullen, who's the Poetry Ireland poet in residence, those words will be available they're probably up there on the website if people want to use those, or they can use the Beethoven words. Which would you rather? Absolutely. Or is there a choice?
Oh, they should use our words, you know, because we're in a situation where, you know, pandemic land, we've got to look upwards and we've got to be positive. So she's written beautiful words. She's had the Irish language incorporated into that. Yeah. So I think that's, I don't think I gave a great rendition of that, but it has the Irish language in there. That's super. It's brilliant. It's for our frontline workers and it's a tip of the hat and respect to them.
Give. It's a lovely, actually, a bilingual type little bit of rhyming going on there as well from Catherine Ann Cullen.
Beautiful.
A great website, odetojoy.ie, and that's where people will find out the detail.
Absolutely, and it's very colourful and it's very friendly. It's very person-friendly. It doesn't matter if you're a child or if you're what type of musician, what grade you are. It doesn't matter. You can play this. You know, it's very simple. And I think if you want to sing along, it's a beautiful, beautiful tune. And I've known it since I was a child. I'm sure everybody knows this tune. You know, when they hear it again, they'll know it.
It was a trumpet you played, wasn't it, John?
It was bass I played.
Oh, bass. Oh, sorry, your father played the trumpet. I was going to say, will you have the bass? You know, you won't have the bass anywhere near you on Sunday.
My bass days are resting right now.
Might take them out. For the moment. Ode to Joy. If you want everybody else to do it, you should do it too, Joe.
Okay, I'll do it.
I'll start the bass challenge. The bucket challenge starts here with Joe Chibby. I want to see the pictures and I want to see them on the website. I'll be looking on Monday and I'm getting out of here quickly before I'm challenged. odetojoy.ie is where you'll find all of the details for Sunday's nationwide tribute to frontline workers featuring Beethoven's Ode to Joy and Joe Chibby, General Manager of the RTE Concert Orchestra, speaking to us about that this evening. 27 minutes past seven on Friday night's Arena. The Blind Light is the fourth book from novelist Stuart Evers. This new story is an intergenerational family saga spanning six decades, set against a wide span of cultural and indeed historical events, from the nuclear paranoia that started in the late 1950s through to the war on terror and beyond, all told through the prism of the friendship between two former servicemen and the friendship between their families indeed as well. And Stuart Evers joins me now to tell us more. I want to start with Hack Green's secret nuclear bunker and a visit you went there. It must be about 6 years ago at this point, because that's roughly how long I think it took to write the novel. How long ago was it that you went there and what did you see, Stuart?
Well, it was actually 8 years ago.
With my
family. It's where I'm from, in Cheshire. And we went round as a family. And my mother and I share this kind of deep-seated fear of nuclear war and always had done. And we talked about it as I was growing up. And as we walked round the secret nuclear bunker with all the exhibits and sick bay, etc., we were in silence. We didn't really know where to look or what to say. Just we were terrified. We were taken right back to that moment. But there were several people there who were considerably younger than I was, you know, in their 20s, and they looked at it like it was ancient history, like it was something that had happened to a completely, you know, a completely different generation. And I was by the time I got out from underneath, once I got over the kind of fear of it all, I was angry. In fact, I was seething with anger that people had seemingly forgotten just the fear, the sheer fear of it. And so I thought, I'm going to write about this. I'm going to write about the Cold War and particularly that nuclear paranoia, which had such an important sort of influence on me as growing up.
You were born, Stuart, in 1976. And we were, I suppose, we had the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I'll come back to that aspect of the book in a minute. We had the Cuban Missile Crisis in the 1960s and the paranoia that started in the late 1950s into that early section of the Cold War. But in 1976, we're into a different period in the Cold War, it was the dying days of that particular Cold War. But that means you were about seven or eight when that
one which threads the docudrama, the 1984 docudrama.
Yeah.
That even the word I looked at the trailer again today, and I thought, that's enough. I don't need to see any more. I remember it now. When did you first see that? Because it plays an important part in the book.
I saw it when I was about 12.
Right.
And I'd known about it. And it had been like this. Well, you remember Video Nasties, and that's what it felt like, because it was never reshown on BBC, but everyone knew about it. Everyone was talking about it the next day. It was on the front cover of the Radio Times, which I remember so vividly, and being so scared of just the front cover of the Radio Times with the man with the gas mask on.
And some of the images within that particular docudrama, you know, they're still frightening. You know, there's the really effective one where you see the woman standing. She's looking at what is the nuclear mushroom blowing up in the sky, and suddenly she begins to wet herself. Or, you know, you see flesh being pulled off bones. I mean, it really was frightening stuff.
Oh, it's it's genuinely, one of the characters in the book says it's the most terrifying work of art ever created. And I kind of stand by that. I just, everything about it is genuinely chilling. And even when you think it can't go any further, the end is so unremittingly bleak. It's so astonishingly violent and unpleasant. And you know, I mean, the rumor is that it affected the course of history, because Reagan saw it. Reagan saw it and was very taken with by its message. So when I was first thinking about this book in my kind of seething anger after coming up from the nuclear bunker, one of the first things that I wrote was must include threads. this kind of novel that was building sort of hour upon hour, week upon week, month upon month, was it felt like there needed to be stages. It felt like there needed to be certain things that would bring people together, and they had to be sometimes they had to be obvious. Obviously, Cuba, you can't write a book about nuclear paranoia and not mention Cuba. While at the same time, I don't think you could do it without mentioning threads. So I thought it was very important to bring those two things together. And the way that I use threads as this kind of defining moment in kind of like that early 80s or early 80s paranoia, that the new Cold War, as it were, where Drum, who's the central character, is suddenly realizing that the fears that he'd had as a younger man are actually coming to fruition, or at least he feels that way.
And, you know, I think what's interesting is because you go back to Drum, that leading character, and the friendship I mentioned is with a man called Carter, a big class difference, which we might touch on in a second. But that goes back to the late 50s, early 60s, that kind of paranoia at that point. Then we have the paranoia that comes later on in and around the 70s. And as you say, with the production of the docudrama Threads. But I wonder, to what extent do you think even this type of paranoia, if that's a right word to use, around where we are today, the kind of anxieties we have in today's world, is it just another version, another tune, if you like, different words to the same tune in terms of our paranoia around the current political situation in the world versus our paranoia around nuclear arms?
Yeah, I think that it's slightly different in timbre, but in general, yes, that's correct. I think the notion of a virus or you know, this pandemic that's going on now is that we have almost an effective way of dealing with it. We know, you know, there are ways that we can mitigate it. With the nuclear paranoia, it was different because it could be just down to a mistake. It could be down to people not quite reading the signals correctly, or as I was doing research, I found out, you know, the amount of times that we were very close to full-scale nuclear war because of a mistake, computer mistake, on a Russian base or on an American base. And I think those that kind of understanding of the proximity to the absolute end of the world is slightly different with that, where you have no control over it. And control is one of the big themes of the book, like how we try to exert control over the things that are in our power to do so. But with something like a nuclear war, nuclear weapons, we're just completely impotent. And I think that's a very scary thing in and of itself, where the arguments between two two men who don't get on with each other across the pond. In the book, I have it as a vain man and a bald man, is how I describe Kennedy versus Khrushchev. But, you know, it suddenly it becomes nothing to do with the rest of the world. It's just about two men and their egos. And that I find terrifying. And, you know, I think certainly the response in the US and the UK to this pandemic proves that that it doesn't take nuclear weapons to turn leaders into people considering about their own legacy rather than actually the people that they're supposed to be representing.
Operation Madoff, this is a real thing. Is it?
Sort of. Sort of. So I was very fortunate enough to write a story for a ghost story set at Dover Castle, and I was actually staying at Dover Castle on the south coast of England, and I was doing a research for a ghost story, and I was given access to someone who runs the facility there, and she told me about various different ghosts and all that kind of thing, and I mentioned something about nuclear bunkers, and she just went off on a completely different tangent. I talked about, because Dover Castle has what would have been a regional seat of government, but the most important one in the country is where a lot of the dignitaries would have gone to run the UK should the bomb drop.
Right, so you have used that real-life situation as a kind of fictional start.
She told me actually, what she did was she said, "I presume you know about whatever it was," and she explained what it was. And I just said yes too quickly. She didn't explain fully, so I just thought I'll have to make it up. So that's what I did. But yeah, I mean, when you think about it, it makes sense, because Operation Madoff, as I have it in the book, is that everybody who was important would have had a space reserved for them somewhere. A nuclear bunker, but what if you weren't in the place where you're supposed to be? So I presume, and from talking to the woman at Dover Castle, I presume that they did model the idea of people being put up in private nuclear bunkers. And so I took that to its illogical conclusion as to what would happen if you needed to test it.
So a kind of an exaggerated version possibly of what could happen. Final question then. I do want to touch on the class aspect of the book, because those two main characters, it's essentially the two families at different points in time between 1950 and the present day, 2019 in fact, is the final sections, is the most up-to-date part that we get, and the different machinations of the relationships between the families. But Drum, who is the working class guy, and Carter, who is the posh guy, how important was that class difference in what you wanted to explore in the book?
Well, it started out that I hadn't even considered it. It was one of those strange things. I tend to write about, not exclusively, but for the most part, I write about working class or perhaps lower middle class people. I don't have much interest in the upper classes. I'm not particularly interested in rich people. But I had a situation where I wanted to explore the different relationships between that people have with fear. And obviously the biggest kind of rebuttal to fear is having lots of money and being able to do something about it, being able to have control. So I had to have Drum meet somebody who had privilege, who had control, who had a way of mitigating against the awfulness. And so I had the meeting in National Service, and I did a lot of research about National Service. And one of the interesting things is that it was very common for the upper class or upper middle class people to meet like the lower orders, as it were, and become very, very good friends for 2 years and then never see each other again. And I wanted it to be the starting point of a very long friendship that would neither of them would really completely understand, because they love each other, but in a very strange and complicated way, complicated by the divide of class and of expectation as well. I think that's one of the other things, is that Carter expects to be safe. Carter expects wealth. and drummers there just to protect it, just to make sure that they don't get made redundant, or that she that he doesn't that he can still provide for his family. So it's a very different kind of reckoning, if you like.
All right, that's Stuart Evers speaking to me there about his current novel, The Blind Light, which is published by Pan Macmillan. Time now for album reviews on Friday Night's Arena, the one that's getting all the headlines. Bob Dylan turned 79 last month, still coming up with the goods, it would seem. His new album is called Rough and Rowdy Ways. After that, Phoebe Bridgers once christened the Millennium Dylan, for better or for worse. Her second album is out today. It's called Punisher. And finally, John Legend, again, once christened the sexiest man alive. Producer, singer, songwriter, actor. And his current offering is entitled Bigger Love. Brian Boyd and Louise Bruton have been listening. But let's start with Bob Dylan. Where else would you start? Rough and Rowdy Ways, 39th studio album. And this is the opening track where he's telling us a little bit about what he thinks he is.
I'll drink to the truth and the things we said. I'll drink to the man that shares your bed. I paint landscapes and I paint news. I contain multitudes. A red Cadillac.
There you go. He's lots of things then. That's only in the first minute or so of Bob Dylan's I Contain Multitudes, the opening track on his latest album, Rough and Rowdy Ways. 79 in May, album number 39. Is he still coming up with the goods, Brian?
Magnificently so. Absolutely magnificently so. That sounds like, it sounds like Cole Porter, that song. It sounds like Tom Waits covering Cole Porter. And it's, some of the stuff is stunning. And you will find there's a common thread, Sean, to the songs in the album. They're almost, there's a valedictory, semi-autobiographical feel to all of them. It's an artist now, as you were saying, 39 albums, 79 years of age, comfortable with his own legacy. And now what he's doing is, instead of looking, he was very introspective as an artist for decades, but now what he's looking at, he's looking at the wider. He was always interested in the myth of the American dream stroke nightmare. He was always very good on dealing with American history. And what he does wonderfully in this album is he can mention, he goes from mentioning Jack Kerouac to Indiana Jones within a few seconds. So he's mixing up characters from the Old Testament. He's mixing up, he's putting in references to Buddy Holly, to the Rolling Stones, and he's surveying the ruins of America, as he always has done. I mean, this is a man who's composed, be the song with God on Our Side, told the history of America famously. And that beautiful song, the protest song, Hurricane, which I'm surprised DJs aren't playing these days, because it's about how the police routinely treat black people in the US. This album is so, there's a contemporary feel to it, but there's also a sense of him looking over his shoulder back at his career. It's wonderful stuff.
I Contain Multitudes, that opening track, Louise. He's talking about himself, and he can almost feel him smiling, saying, "Do you know what? I'm going to tell you a little bit about myself now, that maybe things I haven't spoken about before, things I haven't let out there before." I think you found this perhaps a most personable type of Bob Dylan, one that you didn't expect to hear.
I think just from start to finish, he's kind of cracking jokes at himself, and the amount of information that people want to have on him as well, because he isn't always the most admirable of people at times. So I think he's just cracking jokes at the whole kind of mystical element of who Bob Dylan is, in the most kind of Bob sort of way. He gives a little but speaks in riddles about himself, like as Brian was saying there, like he compares himself to Indiana Jones and Frank and the Rolling Stones, and you know, like what, that's who on earth could ever compare themselves to those to that gaggle of people. And I don't know, I think he's just really, he really surprised me, because when you come to an act of a certain vintage, you feel like there is a certain kind of cutoff point of how interesting they can push things. But he's just gone and completely pulled the rug from under what I expected of him. And he's definitely called me out for my ageist ways.
There you go. He had given us three albums kind of exploring the American songbook and to varying states of it. And maybe there was a bit of indulgence there. And you might say, well, there are songs here that are not radio friendly, 9 minutes long, 6 minutes long, and the final album track on the album, Murder Most Foul, 17 minutes long. But he's not being indulgent here. He's kind of saying, look, there's more going on than just, I'm Bob Dylan, I can do what I want.
Very true. And what really impressed me about this is the most underrated thing about Dylan. We've always fell for this myth that he emerged in Greenwich Village coffee shops and he was a protest singer. That was 2 years out of 60 years of his career. And it was a label he really rejected. He was actually saying, I'm not the Messiah. What Bob Dylan is, he's one of the best love song balladeers in popular music ever. And there's a song on here which anyone who doubts that, all they've got to listen to, it's a very unwieldy title, I've Made Up My Mind to Give Myself for You. It's one of the most beautiful love songs he's ever written. Now remember, a lot of people, if you hear Adele singing Make You Feel My Love, people never realised that was a Bob Dylan song. Before that, there was an even better love song, I think he wrote, which Olivia Newton-John made a huge hit with about 30, 40 years ago now, called If Not For You. Dylan has that,
right.
Love goes through his work. I mean, Blood on the Tracks is a bitter love album.
Well, let's listen to the one you've just spoken about, I've Made Up My Mind to Give Myself to You.
Listening to the sounds of the sad guitars, been thinking it all over, and I thought it all through. I've made up my mind to give myself to you.
Now, classical music fans listening to that will hear the dee dum da 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 dee la da 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 dee da da. The barcarolle from the Tales of Hoffmann going on underneath that love
very
song.
Very yeah. Reference there, Sean.
Well, there you go.
There's also
I thought you were going to comment on my singing. I'm very disappointed. Louise, let me just ask Louise about the nature of that love song. Were you surprised there, Louise, that again, it's so personal?
But there's just a real softness in him. On this record as well, that I just found myself just constantly being surprised that he, well, like, how long had he been holding all of this in for? Because as you said, it's his 39th album, and how much of himself has he been given over the years? And now he's showing kind of a lighter side, and even the way that he's looking back on his life, like, he's the song Key West, I find, is a real song that is just someone who's looked back on his life and is happy with everything that he's lived through and done. And he's happy to kind of walk into the older years of his life knowing and achieved everything that he's done things by his own terms. Like, it's very, like, again, it's nothing directly happening in his life, but more just the sentiment that he is happy with everything that he's done.
I don't think I need to ask you stars, but I will anyway, Louise.
Oh, 4 for me.
4 for you. I thought it was going to be the full hand, but maybe I had it wrong. And what are you saying, Brian? Geared the full hand.
6.
To make up for the missing.
It's a magnificent piece of work. This is art. We rarely use the word art in this programme. This is an artistic expression.
All right. So, well, you're clearly both delighted there with Bob Dylan's Rough and Rowdy Ways. Let us move on to Phoebe Bridgers, labelled the Millennial Bob Dylan, on the release of her debut album back in 2017. We listened to the single from the album. This is called, from the new album, this is called Kyoto. Track from the latest album, second album, in fact, from Phoebe Bridgers, that album called Punishers. We don't kind of get that. In some ways, is probably the most upbeat track on the album, Louise. Who are we talking about, first of all, when we talk about Phoebe Bridgers?
So Phoebe Bridgers is 25 years old, and she would have released her first album a few years ago when she was 23. So there's a lot of weight given to the fact that she has such a wide-eyed view of the world for someone who's performing so young. But she's also involved with, she's in two other super groups, I suppose would be the name, Boy Genius with Julian Baker and Lucy Dacus. And then she has an album with Conor Oberst called Better Oblivion Community Centre. So she is kind of a darling of the indie scene. And yeah, she's very emotionally astute. And I think that there's something quite, she's very intelligent, but her voice, I think her voice, it's almost at a whisper all the time. That causes you to listen a little bit harder. So even if she's singing softly, she's cutting deep with a lot of her words towards kind of herself. Like she takes a lot of issues with herself and kind of different highs and lows that she goes through with life. And particularly with songs about ex-lovers, she just knows how to take someone down. But it's something that you could miss if you aren't paying attention, which
I think
there's
a kind of a gentle quality that you might be misled by. Brian, she addressed the difficult second album question quite well by waiting, really. That was her trick.
It didn't work for her. This album didn't work for me at all. The problem with her is that she released this debut album and it was a perfect storm. She had just got out of this, what she alleges was an abusive relationship with the musician Ryan Adams, and it was all finger-picked, acoustic, sad folk music, and it just worked perfectly. This doesn't. She has, she's tried to, like we heard there, the opening track there was an upbeat song. It sounds like her record company said, oh, Phoebe, can you write a mid-tempo, better pace tempo and make a happy song? It's a lot of this album sounds like that. She's brought in horn sections, she's brought in orchestral strings, and she's really got nothing to say. The song, if you listen to the songs, and it's like, for the last 3 years I've been going around the world and I don't really like it and I prefer to be at home. You can't make an album out of that, Sean.
I don't know, where then, Louise, did this idea that she was the millennial Bob Dylan come from?
Oh, well, I would completely disagree with Brian, because I think that she finds the everyday sadness and she's able to just kind of highlight it in these lines. I think each line is just so heavy in its delivery. Mm. Say, Garden Song is a song just about missed snapshots with people. And she says, when I grow up, I'm going to look up from my phone and see my life. So this is someone at the age of 25 who already feels that life is passing them by because they can't keep up. And she gives such gravitas to this sadness, especially on Moonsong, which is a song that kind of walks through the repetitive torture that we inflict in the name of romance and love.
Right, okay. And so it really worked for you then, Louise. Stars?
Oh, it's a 5 stars for me.
A 5 star for you on this one. Now, don't reduce yours now, Brian. he's aghast in studio.
3. There's some good songs in the album, but overall I didn't like it, but 3.
3, okay, but some good songs, but overall, no. Let us move on then to John Legend. Before I play a little bit from this, maybe give us a sense of what John Legend has achieved to date, Brian.
An awful, awful lot. John Legend broke through in 2004, 16 years ago, with his debut album, Get Lifted. He was managed at the time by Kanye West, and a lot was expected from him. What if you can imagine... soul and R&B come up with a Coldplay. That's what John Legend is, in that he has a very sleek sound. He has a beautiful vocal stylings. The production is the best, the most expensive production you can get. The songs reach a wide audience. They are lacking in character.
Right, let's listen to Remember Us.
At least that's how it used to seem. Oh, I remember this. Yeah, I remember this. Some days I sit and reminisce. Do you? I'm a patient man, but in these times we can't dance or compromise. I miss your laugh, I miss your eyes. They're still there in the back of my mind.
Well, that is a smooth voice, isn't it, Louise? As you listen to John Legend there and Remember Us from his new album, Bigger Love.
Yeah, he could sing absolutely anything. I think that he has just such melody and life in his voice that he could sing anything. And the fact is that a lot of the lyrics are so massively lacking on this album. So Bigger Love is inspired by all of the loves of his life, which is his wife, Chrissy Teigen, his children, and then the rich tradition of black music that he says has made him the artist who he is today. But then when you have songs like Favorite Place, where he has a line, I love it when my roller coaster dips right into your ocean. Makes no sense. It's not enticing. It's not anything anybody really wants to hear.
No, not at all. I cannot unsee that image. Brian, there are 16 songs in this album. Could he have benefited from a bit of editing?
Yeah, there could have been five songs, actually. Only a few songs. The song we just played there, that's a deliberate Al Green tribute song, and it's beautifully done. But the core of this album, you're listening to these songs and you're sort of going, oh, that's a beautiful funky groove. Oh, the vocal is so silky. But once the song is finished, you're going, what was that? I can't remember a thing about it. John Legend has won. He's actually won. He's one of the very few people in the entertainment industry to have won an Emmy, a Grammy, an Oscar, and a Tony. So therefore, right, he has, and he's won 10 Grammy Awards. So there's no reason for him to rock the boat musically, because he already, there's huge cargo on his boat.
EGOT, I'm told, is the acronym for the
Emmy.
There you
go. I think only four people, maybe four.
There's only four EGOTs in the world. I don't know if that's true or not.
He was the first black person to win it. So
let me finish on, I'll come back to you for Stars, Brian. Let me finish with you, Louise, on the fact that this is released on what we call Juneteenth, Black Independence Day.
Yeah, so this Legend says the whole thing was recorded and written before the pandemic, but he has said he brought the album release forward to this date because he says with everything that's going on with Black Lives Matter protests, there's just so many images of black people who are, they're in mourning, they are like, they're fighting up against everything, and he says that it's important to see that black people are humans too, kind of through love, through art, through joy, and this is kind of what he wants this album to be. So I think that there's great power in that, that he can, because he is someone who's quite politically vocal as well. So
stars,
this is his other
stars
side.
From you, Louise.
Three. It's just a bit too schmaltzy.
A bit too schmaltzy. And a final comment from you and stars, Brian.
It was a bit too banal for me. Three also.
Three also from Brian Boyd there and Louise Bruton for John Legend's Bigger Love. We also spoke about Phoebe Bridgers' Punisher and Bob Dylan's Rough and Rowdy Ways. I know which one that they think the both of them want me to get to listen to over the weekend. That is our lot for tonight, indeed for this week. Liam Murphy was the researcher. Kieran Dunn was on sound this evening. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tonight's programme produced by Olin McGowan. Talk to you on Monday at 7. Have a great weekend.